I'm Jacob Kinberg, and you're listening to Salty Cinema. My guest today is writer-director Thomas Purifoy Jr. Thomas's feature documentary, Is Genesis History?, was released in theaters this past February as a one-night-only Fathom event. Its overwhelming success as one of Fathom's most popular events led to two encore screenings. Thomas is based in Nashville, where he runs his production company, Compass Cinema. Here is my conversation with Thomas Purifoy Jr.
When I got into this, I obviously was wanting to do something that was from a more narrative standpoint. And we did, our first series was a much more narrative based, but it was small. And the key is you got to pay the mortgage. So, I mean, eventually you got to find something that's going to make money. But this was our way to segue back into, try to move back into that world to some extent, even though it was, you know, you're good when you're talking about being creative. And someone was surprised. I was a creative writing major the other day. And my daughter was like, well, yeah, I can see that. Like, you know, you just made a documentary. I mean, it wasn't that creative. Like, thank you. And thank you. Cause yes, you're right. It's true. There are things you can do that are more creative. So, you know, you call it like it is. But so I feel like we're kind of on the edge of like, it wasn't even a truly real documentary. Mm-hmm. So it was a little, what you're doing with this police is a much more real documentary.
Well, yeah, that project is more like verite, you know, style.
Well, I love the Maisels
documentaries like
that are highly controlled.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you are documenting something. It was the best we could do with this. If I could have done it the way I wanted to do it, it would have taken us forever and a lot more money. Mm. Meaning I would have followed people around and really would have dug in and gotten a lot more research done watching them do stuff. But, I mean, that would take a long time and a lot of money. So
yeah, as it is, it covers so much ground. Like,
that was what I had chose to do. I knew it was a very so it did something exactly what I wanted it to do, knowing what I had in money and what I felt the need was and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, but it wasn't, as we all are like, creatively, we'd like to do this. This would have been great. Mm-hmm. And you just can't always do that.
Let's start with just talking about the genre in general of documentaries and what made you, I assume, is Genesis History your first documentary?
So it was our first feature-length documentary.
Okay.
So we have done a number of documentaries in the past, and I love documentary work. It's always been short format. So the first thing we did, the first documentary I guess I did, was when our series Modern Parables, we did six of the parables and modernized them using different film styles. So I did one was a comedy, one a Frank Capra comedy, one was, you know, Tip the Hat to Orson Welles, one was a black and white, and then I did a documentary.
Okay.
And we did a documentary, we followed a wheat farmer with following his wheat, basically from it, we didn't quite catch it sowing it. We of course mocked that, but then we followed the wheat harvest all the way through harvest. So it was about a 4 to 5 month deal. It was great, and that was a lot of fun. I love the real documentary filmmaking where you're really following it, you're really finding the story in the middle of it, and moving along. And then we also did a series for the Heritage Foundation called Seek Social Justice, which was I think six short documentaries. And all about 12, 15 minutes each. One was we followed it was actually a ministry down in Dallas where this white guy and a black lady had gotten to be really good friends over her son. And he had been killed in a drive-by shooting. Mm. And then they stuck together as how do we bridge these communities and create a ministry called Bridge Builders. And which has been huge in Dallas, bridging these, you know, the rich white communities and the poor black communities in Bon Ton. But what was really interesting was what it opened our eyes to was the issues of welfare and how basically Bon Ton had been a very, probably lower middle class, healthy community until welfare got a hold of it in the 60s, late 60s, and they kind of destroyed the community. This was coming from an African-American lady explaining exactly what had happened to get to there. So all to say is we had done a lot of documentary work, and I prefer, you know, the Maisels, that sense of an honest documentary that just captures the material. Mm-hmm. I mean, as honest as a documentary can be.
Yeah. As a way to communicate specific information that you want to get across to a particular audience, do you think Do you think documentaries are specifically suited and a good thing for Christians in spreading the gospel and anything that they want to share with a larger audience?
Yeah, you know, I think that film in general has every aspect, every medium of it has an interesting positive and negatives. And if you look back even with the start of documentary, let's say take Nanook, and you realize that when he first shot it, he lost all his footage and he had to go back and redo it. There's a fire, I think he lost all his, like the silver or whatever, the celluloid burned. And he had to recreate all of those situations that were real-ish, but not real. And people kind of pushed against him and said, okay, so was this? Are you doing this real? Is it not real? What's really real? I think as filmmakers, we have to always say, what is the goal of the film? And then how does the medium best explore it? So I think that there's always a sense we know that all films are lying. I mean, like, there is no film that doesn't lie, because the camera has to be, unless you're doing an Andy Warhol and you're going to run it for 6 hours showing the Empire State Building. I mean, there's a sense in which you think, well, but even then, the limitations on what's on the frame. I mean, you don't know what's left and right of that frame at that moment, right, which if you were there, you would. So I think that the challenge with film is that it can seem like it's truer than it is, even though, at the flip side, it can show very true things that are very real. It can capture emotions and capture moments that are real. So I think that as Christians, we have to be always be thoughtful to the medium. I think this is not just Christians, all filmmakers do, in knowing what are we trying to say, and is that medium the best method way to lay it out. So I think that I think Christians could explore film, documentary. They have a lot of options for it, possibly more so even than, you know, the secular community, because there's a way of, you can show the spiritual nature of things a little easier in an authentic documentary. It gets harder, I think, as you do something more and more narrative based to show the spiritual nature of things in a way that doesn't come off as cheesy.
Mm. And do you think, obviously, the type of information that you were laying out in Is Genesis History has been laid out in various forms, and you must have thought, okay, what is different about doing a documentary and laying it out this way that will have an impact that a book wouldn't, or another form?
Well, and I think it's interesting. I was actually, we were showing the film to Answers in Genesis just because we were trying to get partners involved in this, and Ken Ham was watching this, and we showed a little snip, the segment out of the Great Unconformity, which is this section where really, I mean, it's this huge erosional unconformity across the whole continent. And most people don't know what that is. You say that phrase, you're like, what are you talking about? Mm. But they can see it. And he all of a sudden stood up in his chair and he's like, oh, this is totally different. Like, I've never seen, he is a creation ministry guy, and he goes, I've never seen this like that. And so I think that what a documentary does bring, and so is talk honesty and truth, you can show real things and say, okay, that is big. And if I didn't show it in the film, but we filmed it and we were in South Dakota. I mean, like, it's there. We just didn't happen to, that wasn't part of this film.
Mm.
That these are real things that are out there that I think Christians, and not even Christians, everyone has to, most people don't know what's in the actual world. They don't know how strange it is. Like, there's some things that, like, don't even make sense from a creation or evolution or any standpoint. You're like, well, that's just weird. And I think that's the world, is that when you start looking at the world, what a documentary will do is let you see this. And someone can actually see the Schnebley Hill Formation, which is a weird thing, but there it is. And you start looking around at this stuff. So it can give you that vicarious experience that I think is necessary to begin to engage the world. And that's one of the things we really wanted to bring to this, was to let people see things for themselves in the creation. Because I think that the creation itself is, in some cases, its own best argument for creation. That it's Romans 1:20, you know, that since the creation of the world, God's invisible properties, his divine nature and power have been clearly seen through what has been made. And it's interesting, he says, so that men are without excuse. But then he moves on and says they begin to worship the creation. So obviously, you want to talk general revelation, it's useful, it's there, but it's not sufficient. You have to have, you know, some specific revelation, some special revelation to kind of say, okay, well, it actually was a flood. There actually was somebody that created this.
So you mentioned liking the Maisels and that style of documentary, and watching Is Genesis History, obviously it's more just informational. It's about getting across something. It's not a piece of art or, Mm-mm. you know, but is there, do you wrestle with having that artistic side and you wanting to make artistic things, but also there's important information that you want to spread in the world and you think that is important too. And, kind of deciding what kind of films that you're going to make depending on what's better as just information sharing or an artistic endeavor.
It's a hard deal. I think that it's really a sign. I think we all see it. It's an artistic failure that we all kind of know that you're like, okay, I tried to do it this way and I only was able to go this far with it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this, when I came at this, I could have attacked it any way I wanted to.
Yeah.
I mean, I had freedom to do it any way I wanted. And as I began to approach it, it was possibly lack of creativity to be able to, what I knew I needed to do was A, show people the real things, but I also knew that they knew almost nothing about this. So mm-hmm. my audience was, unlike some topics, they really don't know a lot about the sediment layers or genetics, or even though they may have heard these things, they didn't really dig deep into it. And there were so many that I felt like I needed to give people the big picture, and that the quantity of items had a quality of itself, just to say, whoa, this is not just a few things, it's a lot. So what normally I would have done to have a pacing that would have kind of slowly built in, let people see people and meet them and see them in their environment, I just simply didn't have time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we covered 13 people in this,
yeah,
and I was cutting people out. And I felt I only gave the tip of the iceberg. So in this case, yes, I felt I was forced to, that the role that I had is that there are many Christians out there who are, and this film is made for Christians. I mean, it's great non-Christians want to look at it. Most of them hate it, but that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
The film is made for Christians in the sense of saying, look, there is so much evidence and you don't know what this is.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted in a sense to a little bit fire hose feed them.
Yeah.
And then to realize that, okay, wait, so this is just a little bit of it?
Yeah.
And I think that Christians get a lot of, they are, especially evangelical Christians who say, you know, it seems the Bible is teaching a six-day creation, and it seems that he created them in his kinds, and it seems there's a global flood. I mean, I read the text, it kind of seems that way. I wanted them to say, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that. Whereas the world will bludgeon them at every point to say, right, you're an idiot, you can't believe that, this is crazy. And so that's, in a way, I felt that I had to fall on the information side.
Yeah.
I
think it is to me, it was a clear choice, and it's successful in doing what I feel like it set out to do. It's successful in being that thing, whether that's something that you want to watch
or filmmakers would actually like. And yeah, say, oh, there's a better way of doing this.
But it's successful. It does it really well. It's shot well. It presents the information well, and it's not boring. It's captivating what you're showing and how you chose to do it. I guess the question is just like, for you personally, like, because I struggle with that too, you know, like sometimes there is so much value, like you say, in presenting information specifically through a film in that way, even though it's not a story, a narrative story, and it's not trying to do something artistic, it still serves a purpose, and it's kind of, you know, deciding, okay, maybe when will you make something like that, just because God is calling you to make something that gets truth into the world, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is the question, is I feel like, you know, and this may be not the last time we would do something like this, but I think that one of the aspects that that approach, where you get more personal, what you're saying is basically more artistic. I could have been better to enter into who these scientists are, to see how they think. So that's a really interesting area I feel like I wasn't able to do, that these scientists, what their stories are. Mm-hmm. We've had some of them that considered suicide in various times. We actually caught some of this. I actually went back and did a conference where I have a bunch of them saying, why am I a creationist? And we had one morning where two of them both said, oh, I was on the edge of suicide.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys that's possibly one of the most gifted of the guys I interviewed, who went to Harvard, took the Bible and cut every section out of it that had to do with creation, like with the scissors, and said, okay, so as a high schooler, I've been brought up with the Bible, and then he said, okay, if this isn't really true, and he loved, great scientist, loved evolution, loved science, and basically was going to go up to his treehouse and kill himself because he realized that the world, these things were in, you evolutionary view of the world and an old earth was totally incompatible with the biblical revelation that was in the text, and that the only way most people can reconcile it is they just don't know enough about either. I mean, they really don't know enough or are willing to just allow themselves the tension of contradiction. But your average person, whether they're like a Stephen Jay Gould, who was his professor at Harvard, so one of the greatest evolutionists was his, and this guy was an outspoken creationist at Harvard. I mean, like, this is no slouch intellect. He's quite brilliant. But he had this real struggle of faith. And I think that's an interesting story that it wasn't the story I was able to tell here. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people would say that, well, these creationists, it's not like they think they understand everything. In fact, when you start talking to them, they actually think there's a lot they don't understand, and that's why they're doing this. It's this view that I think that I don't know how well we did this to disabuse people that the creation evolution debate is one of apologetics. This is about, it's most people in the Western world have taken science because of technology. They think science is some ultimate authority. Because you have an iPhone, therefore a scientist can tell us everything. There's all kind of weird problems with that. It's not. It's science changes and changes and changes. There's a functional world we have, and engineers are really useful to apply science. But those are parts of the story that just never came out. They're just literally almost not in the film, other than, I think Todd Wood at one point says, you know, there's a lot we don't understand. But almost every scientist at one point said this, but I was forced into 100 minutes. Yeah. So anyway, not to go on that, but that's a whole side. The personal side of the story, I think, could have been really compelling. And good, bad, or indifferent, I made a choice not to go that direction.
You said, you know, you knew this was a movie for Christians. If you had tried to engage non-Christians on this topic, what do you think you would have done differently, or would that have been possible?
I don't think it's possible to do this, not in a short film. I think this is such an essential issue. I think it's actually the essential issue. You put it in economic terms, you realize how essential things are. There are trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars based on this one view. Meaning, if the Bible is really accurate in its timeline of history and its duration of events, then it means that every university, every textbook, everywhere in the world, their documentaries made, there are stories made, everything is wrong. I mean, that's trillions of dollars of teachers. And a great example is that one of the professors, or one of the scientists we interviewed, was a young grad student, and he had a 30-year professor. Professor is a tenured, brilliant guy, who figured out he was a creationist. Sometimes these guys will kind of keep it low because they know they're going to get hammered for it. And this guy took him in his office and said, I'm not going to let you ruin 30 years of my career. And he was like, why would I do that? Like, literally just a kid to a professor. But they realize this is a big deal. So it's so essential that it's very difficult for people, and this is why we approach this idea of paradigmatic thinking. The word that Thomas Kuhn uses, that a lot of scientists do not like Kuhn's work, a lot of non-scientists sometimes, they're fascinated with it, but they don't really understand it. He uses the word incommensurable, and incommensurability, this idea that one literally can't talk into the other side. And this is not Christian, this is a non, saying that when you have a paradigmatic approach to the evidence, it is almost impossible for the other side to see the other side and have any kind of communication. Usually one displaces the other and or does not allow the other to be. And that's what you see with this conventional view of the world. The creationist view cannot exist anywhere within it because it's matter and antimatter. So I think that you could have, you know, obviously edit people together. But they would have been on. It'd be like looking, okay, well, he's on that side and he's on that side.
Yeah.
And the evidence is so endless. Well, then empiricism is by definition, like as a philosophy, empiricism, you're impossible to know everything. It's the old story, logic. Oh, all swans are white, and that was what was used for generations until they got to Australia and found a black swan. Well, so what does that mean then? We were stating this is all a true statement. Well, it's not. Empiricism, finding little bits of evidence. And most people aren't taught this, is inherently unauthoritative. It's just you can't know enough. And so we think, well, we know all this. We really don't. So hence, every scientist is going to bring evidence to Lasso that he knows. Well, in how is he presenting it? What's it looking like? Well, your average person knows nothing about this. So then it would have been a morass where people would have walked away. Oh, well, there's two sides, and I'm confused about both.
Right. Yeah, I a lot of times documentarians like Michael Moore will get kind of criticized for just doing one side. I've kind of always thought, like, okay, if you want to tell the other side, you make a movie, you know?
Make a movie, exactly right.
Yeah.
Well, and everyone does. I mean, the other side, the conventional view, we've seen this on our Facebook page. People are like, why don't you say both sides? And most people were like, well, everything I watch tells the other side.
Yeah.
You know, and so that was, I knew going in I was only going to say one.
You go into a little bit. Obviously, there are a lot of Christians who would say they do have a biblical worldview who are not young Earth.
Yes.
What else would
yeah, tease that out.
Yeah, I mean, well, and just like, how did you kind of gauge how much you would go into that in the film, knowing your audience?
Well, that's a really good question. And it was something I kind of wrestled with both ways. What I would say, meaning that I come from my denomination, I'm a Presbyterian, there are tons of people I know that would be considering themselves old earth creationists. There's a growing movement of theistic evolutionists in the church today. I think that when I looked at the whole issue, and I've actually written a post on this, and we even had one of the guys, Paul Nelson, in our film, who kind of said, "Ah, I think you're making a false dichotomy." That was after the fact. And he and I had talked about this beforehand, knowing this was an issue. What I realized is that most people look at this argument through a certain lens. So, for instance, I'm going to look at it through the lens of science. Okay, so I'm going to look at scientific data, whatever science is. Let's not go there, but let's just at least look at science. Other people say I'm going to look at it through philosophy, so let's talk about causality, intelligent design. It's really a philosophical argument. And I realized, no, I'm looking at it through the lens of history. What events happened? Mm-hmm. So when you look at it historically, we all know what history is, you know, George Washington lived in a certain time, he did certain things, you know, Declaration of Independence happened, America, and everyone knows history. It's people, it's events, it's time. It's all history is. So if you look at it that way, just as history, there really are only two views of history. So those Christians, take an old earth creationist, they have to deal with, they are basically incorporating the conventional timeline, currently at 13.8 billion years, and then they are trying to fit the biblical material into it. Well, what? Even everyone's going to agree, biblical material, 6,000, 7,000 years, 10,000, even if you have an old Adam, 100,000, that's nothing, literally nothing to 13.8 billion years, which means their majority of their history is exactly the same in terms of events. The views of the Big Bang and the singularity that happened in the way that the galaxies formed, you got 9 billion years of the universal history with no Earth. I mean, that's, and they all agree with it. So what I realize is that, and most Christians don't pick this up, and I think even a lot of old earthers don't pick this up, that they have adopted a history that is totally incommensurable with the biblical history, and they have to just ignore things to make it work. Because most people will go to the Bible then and say, well, Genesis 1 doesn't really tell us the history. It's one guy said, well, it doesn't have anything to do with time. Fair. And I'm like, so what's the real history? So what actually happened? Which means the Bible, which is really a book of history, ignores 99.999% of the history of the world. Even if it's giving just like highlights, as you know, a guy like Hugh Ross would say, the highlights is only a small bit, whereas it seems the Bible's pretty specific about what God is doing in the world. So that's why I realize that they really don't have an argument. They are just adopting the conventional view of history in terms of events and timing. And granted, you got, so if you have the three areas of evolution, galactic evolution, which is the universe, geological evolution, so, well, that's, you know, 9 billion years, and geological evolution, so 4 billion years to get a livable biosphere, and then 500 million years of our, basically the sedimentary record, that's what they would say, this fossil record moved up. Well, you've got two different views then that are Christians say for the cause of that life. So where did that come from? Well, your progressive creationist says, well, God created it in, you know, according to Hugh Ross, 20 to 30 creation events over 20 to 30 million years each, but separating them. I mean, like, this is because you got to deal with the data. Well, that's That's a weird view that doesn't, you can't even go to the Bible to talk about that. And most Christians are like, they believe what? And then there are extinction events, and there's death before Adam for 500 million years or 540 million years. This is just different history. Or theistic evolutionists will say, well, God caused evolution. Well, how? So God's using death to make all this stuff because natural selection is the basis of it, mutations and slow. It starts to kind of fall apart as history. So it's a long way to answer your question that, yes, I knew they would be frustrated. But I felt that they were a small subset within Christianity. The majority of Christians read their Bible and say, I think it kind of makes sense. And all many of them need is a little push to say, well, actually, not only does it make sense, but there's a lot of reasonable scientific data. So although it frustrates them, and I realize that, I think many of them are don't realize the inconsistency historically. And again, most of them want to talk about science, they want to talk about philosophy. They don't want to talk about history. And I rarely find them talk about history. And as soon as they do, you pull a timeline out. There's a great timeline that I think Reasons to Believe puts out that shows, it's hard to find, the timeline of history. And you're like, that is the conventional timeline with days put in over a billion years. Seems like that's whitewashed. And so no one's been able to give me, and no one ever, no one engages me on this, no one's been able to give me a good argument as to why this is a different view of history. They just ignore it. Or they say it's not. Or they say, well, that's just not true what you're saying. But they don't ever engage the data.
So what gave you that idea to look at it through the lens of history, and what kind of got you started on this journey to make this movie?
Probably a few things. One was my, I've mentioned it a few times. You may have heard this in other places. I have, at the time, 10-year-old daughter, and she had just seen... we just watched together the Ken Ham Bill Nye debate, and we of course taught her up, brought her up reading the Bible. Had not really gotten a lot of scientific stuff, but we had obviously taught the Bible as history. And she heard Bill Nye, and what I think she realized is that this is a different view of history. It wasn't the science, because she really couldn't engage the science. What bothered her was like, well, wait, if the Earth is really billions of years old, well, then that what the Bible says about history, that can't be accurate. And she was young enough to think, well, okay, Genesis 1 leads Genesis 2 leads Genesis 3, the Genesis 4, like this doesn't, it seems like it's kind of a narrative. Well, if you break things apart, well, what are you doing? Again, everybody that reads a story knows this. You take away the first part of the story. Well, how do you get to the end? So I think that's what opened my eyes, listening to her ask questions. I was like, so that was one aspect of it. I was like, okay, I know that this is really, this is an issue of history at its base. Secondarily, I have been highly influenced by the work of Gerhardus Voss. He's a theologian in the United States. He was at Princeton back in the, I think he came in the late 19th century, in the early 20th century. He's very famous. He was the first evangelical to develop biblical theology. They actually created a chair for him there. And what Voss makes the argument of is that, and he does this in many cases, he does it really well in some of his sermons, but he does it through all, he's got a book on biblical theology, is that the events of history are the way God has revealed himself in theology. For instance, you see this all through, it's very quickly you see it in the Gospels, when Jesus, he brings this up and they're seeking and saving the lost, it's a sermon. Jesus says that there's a, he's going into this town and there's this little short guy in a tree and he's trying to get to him, and Jesus finds him out and says, I want to go to your house. And so he then goes to his house and tells the story, and he says, look, the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. Well, he's just given us a story, not even, it's a history. It's real things happened. Jesus was real, Zacchaeus was real, real events that actually are the theology embedded within it. When Lazarus is raised from the dead, that is the theology embedded in the history. And what Voss points out is that God has taken history like clay and formed it in a way to reveal his redemptive acts in time. And I think as a filmmaker, this has actually made a lot of sense, because we all know that good stories reveal, they're embedded in it. I mean, this is why I love Jean Renoir. Renoir's stuff, he's a, you know, his poetic realism, however you want to look at it, his stories, they're not heavy-handed. They reveal internally. And that's what we all know is great filmmaking, which is why we don't like films like mine that are documentaries that just have people talking. You want to see actions. You want to see people in the moment, which... this is always, so this is, this to me is the heart of the way the gospel is and where the Bible is the Bible is a book of events that God has specifically chosen. I mean, Paul tells us this in, I think it's like 1 Corinthians 10. He says, look, God all those events in the Old Testament, like, that was for you to understand by. I mean, like, that was the point. And he uses this. So that's kind of maybe a long answer, but filmmaking and storytelling in a real honest way is what in many ways also led me to this, because I realized that that is the way we engage the world. Yeah. And it is a denial of that to suddenly say that there's 99.99% of all this history and God was either not talking, he wasn't doing anything, or if he was doing things, he wasn't talking about it, or he was doing things that certainly did not seem like that's what he would normally be doing. Like, why would God spend millions and millions of years messing around with planetesimals to form our planet? That just seems weird. Like, that doesn't, that's an event that has no congruence with the God we know, and he's revealed all his actions. So the old earth view really hits to me. It is it's a total fabrication. It's a scientific myth that has now been, because everyone needs an origin story, that 100 years, 200 years, people will look back and say, oh, that was the myth of the 20th century. That Big Bang idea, who can believe they actually fell for that?
It's really interesting, that idea of the story and the events in a story underline and create meaning and themes and the things that you're trying to get across in the way you form a story, and God forming the story of the world and mankind to get across his... I think that's amazing.
It all fits. That's great. Which is what he brings up when he says, and most people don't think about it, the Ten Commandments. He says, hey, so the reason that you're going to have a week to work, and the reason that you're going to rest for a day, is because I had a week to work and I rested for a day. Did God need to create in a week? He could have taken it in a second, as Augustine thought. Augustine, however, of course, was influenced by Neoplatonism in the other direction. Mm. So everyone's always influenced by some external philosophy to change Genesis. Mm. So Augustine, everyone likes to point to Augustine. Augustine didn't believe in old ages. He believed that he did it in a second and then revealed it like that for the angels, because he's a Neoplatonist. And we listened to this and they were like, what? That seems crazy. Smart men can be very influenced by their culture. Mm. In the same way, God could have done millions and billions of years. Why not? If he wanted to, he could have. And yet, he intentionally chose 6 days because it was the way he wanted to form time for us. That's why Jesus says, man was not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath was made for man. Like, he's saying the week was made for us. Mm. God did it in a week because that was for us. So hence, the goal in naturalistic view of the world is that none of this has any meaning to us. Whereas the Bible would flip it and say everything has meaning. And as a filmmaker, we see that the pregnancy of meaning within every event. And that's why we love good filmmakers, because you're like, oh, or a good documentary. You're like, they pick that event up and you're like, wow, that's where everything is. It's in that moment.
Yeah.
It's not in the comment. It's Alan Tate, the poet, said, you know, what do you say? I'm not going to quote him well. He talked about the Immaculate Conception of the Essence in Itself, I think, is in one of his poetry poems. But it's the idea that you have the commentary and then you have the content. And you have to have, in a sense, both, but you got to have the content first. If you have the commentary without the content, the explanation of it, you don't have anything. It's just words. You got to have the content first.
Your film was one of the most successful Fathom events that have happened so far. Do you want to talk about why you guys decided to release it that way, and what a Fathom event is?
I think that to be honest, when we first looked at this, we were like, is this a direct-to-DVD piece? How many people really, if you were a betting man, how many people would really go see a creationist movie with a bunch of scientists who were just talking heads? On paper, it really doesn't look very compelling. So when we did it, we really decided a Fathom event was the best way to go, if we were going to even go theatrical. So looking backwards, I think we all might have said, well, maybe it could have gone for a little longer. You just don't know these things, because then it would have required more money from a marketing perspective. Everything takes money. So I think it was the best possible option for where we were. But when we put it together, we began to find partnerships among different areas. So whether it was the creation organizations, whether it was some churches, whether it was homeschool groups, there were lots and lots of kind of pre-existing organizations that we could kind of work with who already had an interest here. And what we found is that because no one had ever done this before, and we were able to get enough of the word out, and there are still a lot of folks who don't even know about the film, just because it was a small event, there was a large outpouring because no one had ever seen this. And so I think that the result, those results have less to do with the film and more to do with a reflection on the audience environment. As my friend Tim Challies, the blogger and pastor, said, writing review of the film, he said, before it came out, so he said, I think that there could be a quiet majority of Christians that are very interested in this, who always read their Bible, seems legitimate, and they've no one's ever kind of validated that, yeah, I think that, that this is not unreasonable. So I think that there's, in some ways, we could say the film is a following of what Augustine said, you know, faith seeking understanding. Like, they already believe, yeah, I think this is true, but like, this is not a leap in the dark. This is actually pretty reasonable. In fact, heck, there's some things that can't really be explained. You know, you're talking about mega sequences and all these huge geological stuff. You're like, that's weird. Like, that's strange. Like, that's not happening today. So what caused that? And these are things even modern geologists within the movement of toward neo-catastrophism are starting to examine. Now, they're quick to say, every book you read, they're like, wow, this isn't the flood. It's really funny. They will bring this up all the time. They'll say, well, it may seem like a global flood. It's not. And like, so reminds me of Hamlet, you know, methinks the queen doth protest too much. Yeah, it's like, why do you keep bringing us up if we're stupid losers, idiots, you know, loons? Why even mention us? You know, everyone knows that's not the case. So why bring it up? So anyway, that was, I think, a lot of it. The Fathom event was just a little bit like sticking this, putting the oil derrick in the ground and there's oil there. We just got hit it at the right time.
Do you think Fathom events are specifically good for documentaries?
You know, I think that they, that's a great question. I think that there's likely documentaries that could do much better in the open theater. The problem with the Fathom is that one night a deal, and that a lot of Americans are like, well, I don't get this one night. I mean, they kind of understand it a little more, but if there's enough interest, I think it could probably go longer. And I think that's, because it's a one night deal, Fathom has been, I mean, just to be full disclosure, I think they've got like 1,100 screens possible. We were open on 700. I think they can go up to 700, 800 screens. That's a limited number of screens in a nation that has up to, I think, 3,000 or 4,000. And so you're not going to reach the full market that way. Now, granted, everyone may not pick it up, but I think that it really depends on the documentary.
Well, once it had done well as a Fathom event, was there any talk of doing a theatrical, having that as a premiere kind of thing?
And then... No, because what you do is everything is marketing. So you drive people to a certain date.
And you're like, and, you won't be able to see it if you don't go.
Yeah, and the thing is you can't go back and redo it. So we had two encores, but because those encores weren't advertised, I mean, they did okay, but they weren't like the first night because not everybody knew about it. There's so much noise out there. Just getting the word out to people is very, very difficult. And this isn't just us. This is everybody says this. So the as a filmmaker, you almost have to invest. Well, that's not true. You do have to invest at least as much as you put in the production on marketing, but possibly a lot more. Otherwise, no one's going to know about it or hear about it, even if it's brilliant and great. Which is why a lot of things that are crap do great because they market them well. People are like, oh, that really wasn't that great, but I saw, but they saw it. They paid their money. So I think that what many filmmakers, we underestimate the necessity and the need for really good marketing. And it seems criminal to spend more on marketing than it does on the product. And yet, if you don't, I mean, I just ran into some filmmakers that spent $1 million. 1.1, 1.2 on a really good little film, and they only spent $100,000 in marketing, and it like fizzled. Nothing that happened with it.
What's the process of getting your film to be a Fathom event?
Well, we had in this case, I think Fathom accepts it. I mean, you can probably go. I mean, some filmmakers can go straight to Fathom. They have some group, some acceptance process. We worked with a marketing. Our executive producers were also a marketing company that already had that relationship, WTA Group. And so they handled all that. And so we were really the man in the middle that They funded it, we made it, and then we worked together in marketing of it, with them driving the marketing and them being the quarterback that put all these marketing distribution pieces together.
Now, do you think that, obviously, you know, they want to make money, but would there be content or types of films that they would just wouldn't let be a Fathom event?
Are there restrictions? I mean, if they're letting Christian stuff in, probably not. I mean, we're kind of the bottom of the barrel, right? No, I think that the Fathom has realized that there's a big market in terms of the faith and film world, for sure, and are embracing it, I think. So I do know that these keep going on more and more, and that we're going to continue to see more and more of these different approaches to theatrical release. I think that it's a strange time for all of us because you've got multiple ways of releasing, and so this issue of where's Netflix, where does Amazon fit on here? Everybody sits at home, and yet people still go to the theaters. I don't know. I don't understand the balance of it. I think they dealt with this in the 50s and 60s when they had the advent of television. It's real interesting to see what the theaters did. And everyone, you know, foretold the doom of the movies, and it didn't happen. They came out with 70mm. They came out and did bigger things. There was a lot of big blockbuster stuff that were big for theaters. And so I think that there will always be a place for that experience. But I think that a lot of it depends on what is that experience you're getting. Is it going to be work better on a smaller screen? Or monetarily, can you get as much, you know?
Did the Fathom event, in your mind, help as its own promotional thing for a DVD
release?
And
it's a marketing piece. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, if you look at it that way, that your theatrical is a form of marketing because you're spending so much time for that day, for that piece, it does give people think, oh, if it's in theaters, well, it must be a bigger piece. Mm-hmm. So there is that absolutely not probably true, but there still is that unwritten assumption that if it makes it to the theaters, well, it must be better. Someone somewhere is keeping, you know, making a decision here. Mm-hmm. Even though we as filmmakers know that's not the case, but that does help because it gets the word out. And it, from a marketing perspective, it has you focus toward a point. So it's what you need. You got to have a point to focus toward, not just a DVD.
Is the DVD and Blu-ray market still a viable thing? Has it been?
I think it is. I mean, we are distributing via digital and Blu-ray and DVD, but I have found, we've seen that the sales have been fine with that. I think certain films will do better.
Yeah, this film seems like something you want to have that you can show.
That's right. And we find that this is one of those things that we find people will say, yeah, I think I did not understand all that, and I think I'd like to see it again. Yeah. And so it, weirdly, because we broke a lot of rules, that probably is one of the rules that will carry on. The rule that we broke was don't make it too complex. Well, the fact that we did means that folks are going to want to see it on DVD. Mm. So that's what it has not seemed to hurt it. Rest of the world, apparently DVD sales continue to go down. But America, I mean, I'm not sure where they are. But in general, for ours, it's not been horrible. I mean, we've seen sales with it.
How did this project come together? Where did the funding for it come from?
I mentioned that my friend Bill Reeves with WTA Group was our executive producer on this. Okay. And he and I have been friends for almost 10 years. He's a great guy and just is one of the best guys in the faith and film world. In terms of marketing, he has marketed some of the biggest films, from the Kendrick Brothers films to anything. If it's a faith and film movie coming out doing well, it's very likely got his fingerprints of his company, WTA Group, on it. A guy named Brian Mitchell was also involved with that, who's his partner there at the company. And he heard about the film and was like, I think what's...
So you were already wanting to make something and you had
already started. Wanted to make it. I'd already put the pieces together for it and was looking for funding. I mean, it's that old filmmaker, okay, well, you know, I got my idea, how do we get funding for it?
And was that Del Tackett? Is that, that's the name?
So Del was involved in it, and I had gotten his okay to be involved in the film.
You wanted him to be your, like,
I wanted Del, yeah, when we're looking for the person. I knew I needed someone to talk in the film, to be a host. And really, it was very providential. Del has a huge national audience. I had a lot of respect for him. I'd watched his Truth Project years before and known how he just is a very thoughtful guy that can work in a lot of different areas. As it got into it, I realized how providential it was. Not only was he just fantastic on screen, But what the things you don't expect is he had great rapport with the scientists because they all respected him. Mm. So it's very easy. I could have had a host that, you know, may have been a good guy, may have been good, but didn't have this respect. He was, I mean, they would, in many cases, there was always one of the, I think it was Steve Austin, would always want to take pictures with Dell in places. Like, look, it's me and Dell Tackett. So I had a host that was, he had that, you know, star factor. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, Dell was really just a providential piece in this, that this could not have happened without him. Mm.
Was that also strategic in, like, not knowing where your funding would come from on the outset when you're wanting to make it, knowing if I have some kind of name with it, I can.
That wasn't what did it. I mean, I think it was important, and I think it was helpful, important for the film. But I know Bill went after the film because of the idea. Mm. I mean, he said he felt it needed to be done, and so this is that decision was one of those. I mean, as a producer director, when you find an executive producer who's like, I just believe in this vision. Yeah. Well, I mean,
that's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what you want. I mean, it's like, yeah, I think we can make money back from it, but, you know, he didn't do it for the money at the end of the day. He did it because he felt it. He's a six-day creationist, and he felt he wanted to film on this. Hmm. And Bill's a great example of that rare executive producer who is committed to the medium and committed to making good films. And that's, I think, what makes him so unique as a as not just an executive producer, because he does a lot of other stuff, as just as part of this industry, is he everyone who knows him knows, he says, oh yeah, he's gold, is because it's not just about the money. It's about what are we doing with what we're doing. Yeah. And that's not as common. Although it may seem strange, there are a lot of people in this industry who are more about the money and, you know.
So as vast as this piece could have been, you know, you could have done it as a TV series, you could have done it as a multi-part thing. Like, how did you decide on the budget of what exactly you wanted to do or what you needed?
You know, we really have been looking back, we're actually trying to make it into a multi-part series because to absorb it, more of it, to go deeper into it. I knew I needed to make it look good. And Bill and I both agreed on that. It had to look as good as we could within the budget constraints. I realized it needed to be big in terms of content. And so as I was doing it, I really realized there's a principle called, and it's not philosophically sound, but it's very functional, called the consilience of induction. It's an evolutionary perspective. I learned it from a friend of mine, Kurt Wise, who learned it from the evolutionists. It's the view that we all know, and we see it in, you know, any forensic case, is that the pieces of evidence at a circumstantial level will jump together, a consilience, a jumping together of all of these pieces, so that they form an argument that the whole is much more powerful than the individual parts. So in this case, I knew I needed to have lots and lots of pieces. As everybody, we would go through one, they're like, okay, that's one point. Oh, that's another point. Oh, that's another point. Oh, these points keep coming.
Yeah.
That the power of many points pushing one after the other creates that consilience of an induction, being obviously what Sherlock Holmes would do. Sherlock Holmes he should have said this idea of taking the details and pointing to it. He never says it's an induction, my dear Watson. It should have been, it's induction, not deduction. That was the idea. I wanted lots of details to pull together that people weren't aware of. And so hence it had to be bigger. And so it required a little more budget because I had to go travel to all these places and cover all these pieces where I could have been a much more digestible film with 8. Mm. And instead I got 16. And so I put 3 in the bonus features. Mm.
So what was the budget for the movie?
The budget was about $500,000.
Okay.
So, which for a documentary that travels, I mean, we spent an enormous amount of that just in travel and in cost. It was probably a little under budgeted looking backwards.
And how long from beginning to end were you working on it?
So we officially started production June 2015, and we officially ended June 2016.
Okay.
And then we were editing on it through the rest of 2016. So I think we had a picture lock. I mean, we had to by the end of 2016.
So going back, what got you started in filmmaking, and What was the origin of that?
Oh, it was probably my mother. She loved films, and we'd sit and watch movies from, you know, young age. American movie classics came out on cable when I was in probably middle school, and so we watched movies all the time. And she loved it, older movies, and she knew all about them, and she would tell me about them. So by the time I was in high school, I actually took a class at, curiously enough at the time, some Arkansas, Bill Clinton's governor school. He was still a governor at the time, and they named the governor school after him. But was introduced to a class on filmmaking and literature. And so that opened my eyes kind of my junior, senior year of high school, like, oh, I want to do this. And so when I was in college, I took all the film classes I had, which is like three at Vanderbilt. There was like none at the time. And then went into the Navy to kind of get life and just management experience. And you should tell people I was going to the Navy to learn how to direct films. They're like, that's crazy. And then you show up on a set and you're like, well, no, the movie set is literally exactly structured like a Navy. Mm-hmm. You got a director who's like the captain. You got the first AD who is like your executive officer. You've got department heads, and they're both called department heads. Like, it's this pyramidal structure that works. I mean, literally, when I walked in as director, I was like, I know how to do this. This is easy. Like, this is what the officer of the deck does. So I did that, and then ended up, basically after that, we had, you know, came back to Nashville and eventually found my way we started this company. But overall, I think that, yeah, I had always wanted to make films in some way that I realized in college that had some Christian impact to it, some worldview impact. And so that's been a little, you know, you kind of have to, if you're a Christian and you go into this world, you're sort of forcing yourself into a ghetto, or you're only going to be able to do so much because you're out of the mainstream of the world. You're not going to do all these big films. Although the reality is most people don't direct big films. It's kind of rare.
So talk about the company that you started, Compass Cinema.
Compass Cinema. Mm-hmm.
And what all do you guys do? What was the first thing?
Yeah, so our first project was something called Modern Parables back in 2007. Okay. And that was when we modernized the parables, and we were sure that was going to be big, and, you know, like everyone is in their first project. And we released it in late 2007, 2008, right as the recession hit. Mm. And it was just like, it didn't sell. So we were like, okay, what are we going to do? And so I realized I needed to have, and this is just kind of a different approach, I felt I needed to have a recurring revenue. I always was afraid as a production company that you're stuck doing work for someone else, and when times are great, it's great, but when times are down. So I wanted to have products. So we really spent time, we did a documentary series. In 2010, we started to do homeschool curriculum, which is very unsexy, but it's stable. And so we got into that world and really stayed in it about 5 or 6 years, building up kind of a base to give me enough, you know, revenue base as a company to enable me then to start working on other projects and developing them. And so that was kind of the long-term idea. It was an economic deal. I mean, filmmaking, if you want to do what we want to do, it's not really an economically structured deal. So I felt like I needed a company base to build off of as a Christian, because no one was going to probably come give me a lot of money, you know, after the first one didn't do well. Mm-hmm. And so hence the film, we've continued to do homeschool curriculum, continue to do curriculum, and then have moved into this product, obviously a project, but with hoping to have many products that will flow from this over the next year. We view it as a product piece. How do you productize something? And I think that's a useful way for filmmakers to think, is how do I productize, which is a terrible grammatical format, but it's true. You know, how do I take this and make many products? So that's what we try to do to some extent. And we control our own distribution. So now I've also got my own, you know, we're small, but an e-commerce store that we've had for a while. And so it's doing things that I would prefer not to have to do, like manage the money and e-commerce of a store and do all that mess, because I know if I don't, then I've got no outlet. So I can kind of control my own destiny to an extent, because I've got a structure underneath me.
And you said earlier that you do have an interest also in doing narrative things.
Yes.
At some point.
I mean, I've always wanted to. I got movies as long as my, you know, arm, all these different ideas I'd like to do. It's just my struggle's been time to sit down and write them.
Do you think that this film or other documentaries could lead to that? Is it
I think that, yes, I mean, I think it's a positive once you've done something a little larger. I think that as soon, it'll be much easier for me to do, I say much, but Lord willing, easier to do another documentary. Mm-hmm. It's stepping over and then into a new world totally. It's like, well, yeah, you did that. Everyone is very suspicious of what you have not done. Mm-hmm. So if you've not done it before, well, are you sure you can do that? And yeah, you've done it in this area, but are you sure you can do even in that area? So I think it's never, we are up against always just the difficulties of, well, that we're in an environment that requires, it's heavily capital intensive for anything we want to do.
Yeah.
And so because of that, people don't like to risk capital. So in that regard, you're having to convince somebody that you're a worthy risk of capital. And it's a narrative film, that can be kind of risky. So
do you know what the next documentary project is yet?
Yeah, I mean, I would like, the follow-on to this was, if it works, is the Bible true? So I see the Enlightenment having kind of, we've inherited three basic questions as Christians that really have never, they've been addressed, and I would even say answered in a scholastic sense, but they've not been addressed culturally as widely. Mm. One is obviously the question of Genesis, and is it really an accurate book of history? In light of, in this case, it was 18th century science that came up, which is always kind of funny. 18th century science that was sure that Genesis wasn't accurate based on certain evidence, that evidence now is totally discounted. Mm. It's like, well, that's not really accurate. Well, no, these are the reasons now we know it's not true.
Right.
So this is what's always funny. When you start relating the history of science, you're like, well, okay, well, if the reasons they originally went to it weren't true, well, so, but you're holding their same conclusion, is it really the evidence that's leading you to the conclusion, or is it the conclusion that you're then going and feeding the evidence into? Not to get into that. The second issue then became the Bible itself. And is the Bible really a good, trustable book? And was it written when it says it was written? By whom it was written about? Concerning whom it was written? So did Moses really write Exodus about a real Exodus that came out of Egypt? I mean, these are all good examples of, and there's throughout the Bible. So you see these all the time. We see this, people say, well, yeah, maybe that's some of that scientific evidence. But we already know Genesis isn't a good book anyway. We already know it's all myths. So the idea that the Bible is basically a book of myths made up and redacted and so forth, I think is the second question. Is it a true book for what it refers to? And then the final question, which would be a documentary a long time coming, but is Jesus God? Hmm. The third question is that the historical Jesus phenomenon that we still have with us today, well, he was a man, but was he really God? Well, yeah, but how do we know that? And so on and so forth. So hence, this is the first of a trilogy, if it were to work out, Lord willing, that would examine these three essential enlightenment questions.
See, all three of those things, to me, are the questions that need to be posed to the world at large. So when we talk about making movies that will only play to a Christian audience, it's something that I still am like, will those be in the same way, or do you want to...
No, the reason is because I do not think movies are evangelical tools. And people use them as evangelical tools. I think it's the church. So to me, people are not going to be convinced. I mean, yes, there are people who talk about being convinced by movies and stuff, and you have this.
Yeah.
I think people, that it's the church that needs to be the one to go out. So the Christian who says, well, you know, I think Genesis is reasonable. Haven't you looked at this, this, and this? The other person's like, huh, okay. But they need to have that conversation. So, right. Yeah, I think the Bible is a good book, and I know Jesus. Well, that movie's not going to go there. Hmm. The movie may say, yes, it's a reasonable book, but I think that my job, and this is mine, there are other people. I heard John Irwin speak, and he said, you know, I feel like our movies are evangelistic. Well, and then you've got, you know, folks like the Kindred Brothers. They have a certain movie. You have to kind of decide who are you and what do you do.
Yeah.
So for me, I am a teacher. And I'm a teacher of Christians. And so non-Christians may find value in this. And we have had some non-Christians watch the film and say, yeah, that really made me think.
Yeah.
But for me, I want Christians to be knowledgeable so they can in turn go to the world. Because in my base, I feel like it's the church is God's plan A, and there is no plan B.
Yeah.
So he's not going to go to Saul. If he wanted a movie, he'd have done that. He didn't. He made a bunch of disciples, and they were walking around, and you know they wrote things down. So we're very secondary, tertiary, as in our role of this. We play a role. I mean, if you look at it, we're like the OSS in World War II. Hmm. Not the main troops, but useful on the side.
Yeah, and it's not speaking to Christians because that's where the money is, or that's who will listen. It's intentional of this is how we feel, this is who we want to educate so that...
They need it. I mean, yeah. I just read the article this morning saying that supposedly creationism is at an all-time low. I would like to think that, you know, tales of our demise have been greatly exaggerated, as if we should ever trust polls anymore anyway. But I do think that there is a very strong push against Christians in this area of wanting to accept evolution, wanting to do this. And this was the goal in the 19th century in England and Europe. And it's what eviscerated the church, because we as a religion are a historical religion. Like, Christians forget that the gospel is not a belief in just kind of a bunch of ideas. The Apostles' Creed is a statement of history. And as soon as you take history out of the equation, that is the soft underbelly. You get history gone, Christianity goes away. It has to, because we're history. So if you take out Genesis, well, the whole, as Martin Lloyd-Jones says, he's a famous British pastor in the 1960s, all of the gospel goes away. It's gone. If Genesis is gone, it doesn't really mean what it says. And so hence, most people kind of think, well, that's not that big of a deal. And so my interest is to say, nope, that's where the battle is. It's not in Matthew. It's actually in Genesis. And if you win that battle, well, the rest of them take care of themselves. If you take time away, if there is no old age and time, it all crumbles. Evolution, Big Bang cosmology goes away. And so hence, you don't fight those battles. You fight at the root of the tree. And the root is time. Time is the root, which is all that Jesus cared about. You know, I came at a certain time in history to do what I'm going to do.
Yeah, it's always been interesting to me that we would have the genealogy from Adam to Jesus.
Why is it there in Luke? I mean, Luke, that's a really interesting section. Luke 3, talking about how an author, and this is interesting as a filmmaker, Luke is editing. So we as an editor know, okay, I'm going to associate three things together. I mean, you know, who is it? The famous, I'm going to forget the Russian that put the early editing, realized, okay, I could take this image and that image and put them together in montage. Luke does that. He provides the baptism of Jesus, and he says, hey, God says, this is my beloved son, you know? And then guess what? We get the genealogy, which is kind of strange, but it ends, he says, this is the son of God, Jesus. It ends, Adam, the son of God. And then we go to the temptation, which is Jesus redoing what Adam did, you know, thousands of years before. Well, why would he put that all together? Because they're all linked. The temptation that Jesus won is the one Adam lost, because Jesus is the second Adam. That's all. It's all editing. I mean, if you want to look at it that way. They didn't really go in that order. I mean, they did. There are a lot of things happened probably between the baptism and that. He inserted that genealogy, which curiously is probably from Mary's and Joseph's line records from the temple. It's like nowhere else, which he would have had access to, because the temple hadn't been destroyed yet. Because every Jew knew your lineage was huge. Where did you go back to? In this case, they were royal family. So they were royals. And like, you know, they were poor royals. So you kept track of that because they went back to David. And so I think that's the thing we as Christians don't realize, is that the genealogies are enormously important, way more important than we realize, because that was their way of tracking time.
Going back to the medium question, knowing that you want to educate Christians in the way that the digital landscape is now, something like Prager University, where you have videos.
Yes.
Why? I mean, obviously, you are a filmmaker. You want to make films. Why not go that route with making a bunch of little videos that dig into the things that you want to dig into?
You know, it's a good question. I think it's because this material, I mean, you can do that, and people have done this. I think it's because this material needs more time. And I mean, and I was even felt bad that I was only given, like, you know, 8 minutes to radioisotope dating, or six. Mm-hmm. It's not possible. It's the old saying, you can't get the doctrine of the atonement on a bumper sticker. It just doesn't work. And so the real solution, I think, in the creation evolution issues and debate is to teach Christians the positive case for creation. It's not anti-evolution arguments. You don't beat something with nothing. You got to beat it with the positive case and say, no, created kinds that have diversification from these unique creatures with genetic blueprints built into them, that makes a heck of a lot more sense than this idea that these things occurred over long, long ages, you know, with random things. your average person's like, yeah, that actually does make more sense. That someone designed this. And then guess what? It's testable. We can see it through breeding. Like, these are designs, dogs, and they just kind of, it's all there. Your lab and all, it's all inside the genetic code of the dog in some weird, inexplicable way. And yet it's there because we do it. And they do it all the time. So I think that that's really the big deal. You can't teach that quickly. And that a lot of people, unfortunately, want it quick. And then when they go get in a discussion with somebody that is basically examining this positive case of evolution, which has had 200 years to build and is very robust, and very brilliant people have taken the evidence and marshaled it together, evidence that really in some cases is extremely intractable for evolution. Like, there's some weird problems that the evolutionist is like, there's really no good explanation for. So either A, it gets ignored, or B, a guy like Stephen Jay Gould comes up with punctuated equilibrium to deal with a fossil record. It's a brilliant way to explain why there's total stasis in the fossil record and all of a sudden is punctuated by these sudden changes that you really can't see. Because there really isn't a lot of these classic gradual transitional forms in there. Now, he's not accepted by all evolutionists, and most people don't know that the hidden secret of evolution is there's no mechanism that everyone agrees on. Everyone is arguing on what's really the mechanism. Now, to a general front, we know evolution works, but how does it work? Well, you dig into it, there are all sorts of camps that disagree. And there's a whole world of epigenetics has come in. Well, if Christians know that, and they know that, okay, wait, there's something, we A, have a better answer, and B, there's all kinds of fragmentary views here. Well, that's, and what's our answer based on is a book that we feel like is an authority. Well, it's much more powerful, but you can't do that quick.
Yeah.
I mean, you can try, and we can try to do short stuff, but what I find is that unless you are putting sustained thought into this, which is most people don't want to do, it's really hard to walk away knowing. And I've struggled with this, trying to teach this. I feel like, again, failures. One of my failures has been to how do I really have someone walk away understanding this positive case? And I don't think I'm there yet. I think I've got more things to make out of this to try to... Okay, you saw the film, but the film is kind of here, there, and yonder. How do you start systematically, if you're going to go take time to understand all these things? The material's there. I mean, I've filmed it. I've got the material. It's just how do I repackage it in a way that teaches this?
Can you talk about the response critically to your film?
Oh, folks hated it or loved it.
Hated it.
It was one or the other. You know, I think that the best responses are the ones that are like a 3-star or a 4-star, because it's always 1 or 5 stars. In fact, IMDb held at 5 for a long time, which I think was about the right accurate, and then all of a sudden it came out on Netflix and pushed down to a 3. And then you look, though, it's great. IMDb says it's got 3% of people, you know, it got a 3-star or a 3 out of 10. And then it says 80% of people liked it. So, you know, and that to me is the perfect example of it. On Google, when you type it in, it comes up. It's this extreme response that most people are responding to the content and not the way the film was. And so the critical response is that it depends really where you're coming from. So every now and then you'll get someone who said, yeah, it's really just talking heads, but it's pretty. You're like, okay, that's what the film is. Yeah, you're right.
Do you think that films should be critiqued in that way where, like, could someone have totally disagreed with everything you did but really admired the filmmaking and say, this is a good film?
So you'll see a few people say that and say, yes, I think it was really beautiful, but I totally disagree with everything they're saying. I think that basically this topic is a total... It's a sword. I mean, it's the sword of Damocles. It's going to cut straight through.
Yeah.
And it can't not, because it's who we are. The issues of origin is the... So if there's 4 basic questions that we all deal with philosophically, they are, where am I from? What am I? What am I supposed to do? And where am I going? You know, the old questions of... I don't remember all the philosophical names for them, but those are the 4 questions. This deals with where am I from, for sure. And then it deals with what am I? Because if where I'm from determines my ontology, my being, well, it really also kind of deals into issues of ethics. And then it kind of deals with teleology. Where am I headed? What's my purpose? So really this addresses all of the central issues of philosophy come out of this, which means it's like touching someone's belly button. They're going to squirm. Mm-hmm. Like you push hard enough on it, and this one pushes hard.
Yeah.
So either they're going to really embrace it, or they're going to totally spit it out of their mouth. Mm. Because, and this is really interesting, I will follow, I've got a Google, you know, alert that comes up. It'll tell me when this movie's being mentioned, and it gets talked about on forums a lot. So I can kind of like, just kind of, it's like literally pulling back, opening a door and listening to conversations people are having about the film. And a lot of them are non-Christians talking about it, especially when it hit Netflix. And I had this lady who was watching it, who clearly did not, he came from an atheistic evolutionary standpoint, but her husband was not some form of a, you know, a Christian who accepted this material. And she was going back and forth with a friend and said, I can't let my husband know I'm watching this. Because if he did, he would say that this, that, how did she phrase it? That if this is true, then everything, all the science I believe in must be false. And now, she got it. Like, these are black and white. There is no middle ground in terms of the science she believes in is the conventional science. And that's, and there's all sorts of views of science, all sorts of views of Big Bang, all sorts of views of cosmology that aren't Christian. I mean, plasma theory and steady state. Science as a monolithic view is totally a myth. I mean, it'd be like going to a Christian and saying, you know, religion tells us that you should be baptized when you believe in Jesus. And everybody would be like, what? That doesn't make any sense. There's no religion out there. There are Baptists who say that, but Presbyterians don't, and Methodists don't, and then surely Roman Catholics don't. And a Muslim looks at this and would say, religion? No, you're all wrong. So we use science, though, in that way. Oh, science tells us this, science tells us that. And when you start sitting here, like, there is no science. Just as there's no religion, it's a construct that we like that's useful for us. There are scientists that say various things, and there may be a group of scientists that are dominant at any one point, but just wait a little while, they will no longer be dominant. Something else will come and take its place.
What are some of the films recently that you have enjoyed that have been released?
Loved Spider-Man. So, big Marvel comic fan. I always like what they're doing. I'm ashamed to say I don't watch a lot of films that come out. I don't watch as many films as I would like, period. If I do watch films, it's usually older stuff. Mm. I teach a film class, and I prefer to watch older films. And so I think I recently watched The Odd Couple again. My girls love older films. I'm kind of brought up in the 50s. They don't watch a lot of modern stuff, but they watch all the older stuff. And so they're always watching something new to them, but that's probably 50 years old. So I enjoyed that. I'm trying to think if I've seen a documentary that I really... I'm excited. I've not seen it yet. The Heart of Man is coming out. Mm. And that looks like that's going to be a really neat, different approach to a documentary. Again, not my preference in documentary is what you would probably be. It's that verite. It's not. It's a bunch of talking heads and then kind of this story attached to it, which is intriguing. So I can't say I've seen a lot of great stuff of recent, even though I know there's probably a lot of good stuff out there.
So where do you teach?
Oh, I've got a little homeschool class.
Oh, okay.
My daughters are in a co-op, and they asked me to teach a class last year. So I taught a history of filmmaking, basically, up to the 60s, really. So we went from the silence all the way to the 60s. And I teach kids how to make films in light of the old filmmakers. And so I feel like we as Christians, if anything, we should know film history. Like, it's totally inexcusable for a filmmaker. And I'll often ask people, so tell me your top five films prior to 1960. And if they can't say anything, I'm like, well, you don't even deserve to be a filmmaker yet. Like, you need to go learn film before you can be a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Like, that's the sine qua non. I mean, like, you got to have that. So hence, I like to teach people this. I feel like that's where the greats are, or in the past. I mean, there's some good guys doing stuff today, but I mean, Scorsese, so here's a great example. I really respect Scorsese as a filmmaker. I totally detest him in his content. That's a great example. How do you separate content and so forth? But I think it's interesting, his movie Silence, I haven't seen yet. They always come back. All great filmmakers come back to the questions of the faith. You know, George Stevens began to look at this in his later on in life. I mean, they realized that what we did in the past was, okay, yeah, it may have been exciting, but that's not what things matter. So Scorsese is incredibly talented today as a filmmaker. And in many cases, in my opinion, he squandered much of his talent on stupid content when he could have been doing great things. I mean, Spielberg picked this up early. He stopped and was like, okay, I've got to do better stuff. And all of a sudden you see things like The Color Purple and then Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan and great work. And he was shifted young enough or early enough to know to say, wait, I'm doing just I'm doing Kleenex. I'm doing things that are throwaway. Mm-hmm. Even though he still does that some, every filmmaker, I think, comes to a point where they're like, what is my contribution? How am I putting back into things? What's going to last? You know, do you want to be known by Goodfellas or do you want to be known by Silence? And yeah, people may think Goodfellas, but it's rough. Mm-hmm. So anyway, in closing, yes, I think that we need to look at the past and we need to study what's great. And as Christian filmmakers, that's our goal, whether documentaries, whether narrative, is that we Christian, and I think it's great, we have an opportunity. Christian filmmaking is at its absolutely nascent point. There's been such little done that we have such opportunities. If Chariots of Fire is still considered one of the greatest Christian films and it wasn't made by a Christian and it's what, 40 years old, it shows that there really has not been an enormous amount of development, that there are some nice, good things that are starts, that are fine films out there, but there isn't a world of great filmmaking waiting for Christians. It just simply hasn't been done.